Spellcaster Media presents.
And welcome to episode 127 of the Creepy Kingdom Podcast. A podcast about the spookiness of films, theme parks, and beyond. I am your host, Mr. James H. Carter II. And I am here with a show jam-packed with so much awesomeness. Awesomeness. Can't even say awesomeness right. That's awesome. It's bursting at the seams. That's right. I'm joined by Josh Taylor from Network 1901, and we are going to break down all the awesomeness from day one of the Ultimate Halloween Festival that just took place July 29th and 30th in Long Beach, California, and that festival is Midsummer Scream. And at the end of us gabbing away, telling you all the awesomeness, we will present to you in its entirety the opening panel from Midsummer Scream, a retrospective on the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror with Rick West from Theme Park Adventure. Remember him from a few episodes back to the awesome stories about building Indiana Jones. He moderates it with the creators of the attraction. Mind-blowing stuff. You guys are gonna love it. I loved watching it. So all you guys will hear it at the end. But before that, Josh and I give you a full rundown of everything that we experienced on day one of Midsummer Scream 2017. Alrighty, I'm here with Josh Taylor from Network 1901, Modern Mouse Radio, the world that never was, and probably six or seven other podcasts I can't remember right now. But how you doing, Josh?
I'm doing fantastic, man. I'm so excited to talk none of my things with you.
None of my things? Oh, yeah, because we didn't do them together?
Well, and also, I'm not talking about any of my podcasts. I'm not promoting anything. I'm not here to promo, which is kind of cool. I like not having to, shamelessly show myself. I'm just here to talk about, the fun and excitement of the Halloween season.
Which officially starts at the end of July. It's happening right now. It officially starts because we are going to talk about Midsummer Scream. Josh came out with me and helped me on the first day of Midsummer Scream to cover the event for all you guys. And in case you were there, or in case you weren't there, but even if you were there, you probably didn't catch everything. So, but between the two of us, we sure as heck caught a whole lot of stuff that we're going to have fun talking to you all about.
I think so.
So, in case you're unfamiliar with Midsummer Scream, it is a they call it a Halloween festival. It's much more than that. It's a Halloween festival. It's a celebration of haunts. It's a celebration of theme parks and the darker side of theme parks, which is fits us like a glove, obviously. And it's kind of an event that's for fans by fans, and it feels like nothing else that I've ever been to. This is only the second year that they've had it. And even last year when I went, I was like, wow, this is something really special. And that just multiplied in its specialness and its awesomeness in just 1 year. And also in attendance, I believe I heard that there's three times as many people this year than last year. So the word
felt like it. It definitely felt like it.
Yeah, it was packed. The word has hit the street. It took place in Long Beach, California. Was it July 29th and 30th? And at the Long Beach Convention Center. And they might have actually outgrown the Long Beach Convention Center in just 2 years. Because, I don't know, but it was packed. My other thought, which I think I said this last year, and I'll say it again this year, I really think the event needs to be 3 days. Because that way, because there's just way too much going on to try to bring it all in. And we went hard ourselves to do it, but I guess it depends what you really want out of a convention, you know, but
true. It has a lot to offer a variety of people. I know that my roommates went with us, and their only intention of the whole day was really to check out some of the previews for this season's upcoming haunts. They had all these mini haunts, I think 14 altogether.
Yeah, then they have a room called the Hall of Shadows, where 14 mini haunts are all set up, giving you a preview of what's coming up for the season. That's a pretty unique experience.
It is, and if you were just to do that, that would be a majority of your day. There were several escape rooms in attendance that had miniature escape room games. The show floor had tons of shopping, so if you're into that, of course, there were all of the panels, which we'll probably go over at length. And that was much more informational. There was so much going on. There was so many different ways you can enjoy this type of convention. Mm-hmm. Versus, you know, I want to compare it to the D23 Expo, as it's Disney and your show is like half, you know, scary, spooky, half Disney.
Right.
The D23 Expo very much wants you to enjoy shopping and panels. And for the most part, the experience for everyone is very similar.
Right.
There's so much variety here. It was almost a breath of fresh air because there were so many people who would just hang out in the haunts all day and didn't have to take up space at panels or vice versa. So it allowed people to kind of separate into their own segments of what they wanted to enjoy while still probably getting a taste of what else was there.
That's true. And another thing that we didn't bring up, too, is that it's a perfect opportunity for people to flaunt their amazing cosplays, because there was no shortage of that this entire weekend.
That's true. Yes.
Definitely dark and spooky and car-related cosplays all over the place. They also, which we didn't cover at all, which is not really relevant to our show, which we didn't cover it, they had tons of classes if you want to learn how to do makeup, special effects, your home haunts, whatever. I mean, this could be a week long. I mean, I'm thinking about it. I mean, it's so much jam-packed into, you know, I think the tickets were $30. But for most,
it was a great deal.
Yeah, and was that for the weekend or just the day? I don't.
That was the day. So I think with taxes and everything, it ended up being like $35. Or if you wanted to do the full weekend, it ended up with taxes being like $49 or $48. So for $50, you can spend your whole weekend immersed in this. And I would recommend it. I think both days. I wish I would have done both days. I tried to pack in as much as I could in one day. Yeah. And I was lucky, you know, we divided and conquered. But like you said, I think it could go 3 days or 2.5 days or whatever the case may be, and still feel like a lot of stuff will go missed.
For sure. And also this year, and I'm sure they'll repeat it again next year, the tickets went on sale pretty early, maybe even as early as March. And they were available for like 50% off for like a long time. So
it could be even cheaper.
Yeah, so totally. You can take advantage of that, you know, get the jump on it early. But needless to say, we're a year out from next year, so, which they did say they're coming back. That is official, so we're very glad. I don't know, like I said, I don't know if it's gonna be at Long Beach again or whatever, but they're definitely coming back. But let's recap day one. We're gonna do day one on this episode since Josh was with for 1 day. And so we could start with what we did together to start off this this day. It was the perfect way to start off Midsummer Scream. It was the ultimate panel for Creepy Kingdom. I don't think there was another more appropriate thing for us to cover.
No, not really.
And this was a retrospective on the Tower of Terror. They had people there, and forgive me for not remembering their names. I don't know if you jotted those names down. But that designed and worked on the construction and all this stuff of the original Tower of Terror, and then duplicating it in California, as well as Mark Silverman, who does the voice of Rod Serling in both the attractions. Clearly a crowd favorite. Every time he did the voice, everybody got real. It was like the Beatles were on stage. People were losing their minds. But like I said, so this, for people listening, this entire panel, the audio of it, will be after us talking about the day. Because clearly I know that's what everybody wants to hear that wasn't there. So we won't, you know, I guess there's no real spoilers in it. But what are your thoughts when you're watching
that panel? There were some great stories that came from this. They brought up mostly from Orlando. They didn't really touch too much upon some of the others. They did here and there. Mm-hmm. But they really focused on Orlando, you know, stating that it was the possibility of having an attached hotel, the possibility of being a Mel Brooks story before the Twilight Zone franchise was added to it. And the story that really struck me that was really interesting to me, mm-hmm. I don't know if it was to you or not, but the first, when they talked about their very first ride through as Imagineers from it and going from the first shaft into, you know, what they call the fifth dimension, where you're basically on a dark ride at that point, going into the second shaft, they did not know. Nobody had the foresight to remember if there was going to be the cab there to catch them. So, like, the actual story of the ride of falling to your death could have possibly happened in that very first ride through from a lot of Imagineers. And they had, like, all of their flashlights out to see if, like, they could walkie-talkie to, you know, someone to pull an emergency brake or somehow pull off a miracle. But the thing was there, it caught them, and luckily no one died. That would be unfortunate. But I thought that was a great story. There were other stories crazy that were like that involved in the show.
Yeah, there's one story which, I mean, I haven't re-listened to it, so I'm kind of lost on it. And listeners will hear it, and it'll be clarified as well. But I was kind of confused. They were showing slides, and on one of the slides during construction, Bozo the Clown was on site.
Oh, yes.
And I was pretty confused on what was going on there.
I think they were stating that, like, this attraction, when they were building it, was conquering a lot of people's fears. And for whatever reason, Bozo was in the clown, either shooting a commercial or for some reason.
Okay.
And they called him over because, you know, some people have fears of clowns. And so it was just, like, appropriate that we were getting over this fear of heights and, you know, serious drops and all these different things. We might as well, like, just add in another fear. I think that was their story. Again, the audio that you can listen to will fully clarify.
Right.
But I think that's what they said. Funny little slide, too.
Right, yeah. So, well, I'll put as many of these photos in the show notes as possible. A lot of what we talked about, if you followed our social media, we're posting like crazy all weekend, so you might have seen a little hint to this. But I'll try to condense this all in one place, but there's a lot of photos, so we'll do our best with all those. But yes, overall, like I said, this was a really cool panel. I mean, they have you know, I want more of stuff like this. I mean, that's definitely catered to, you know, to the Creepy Kingdom type of stuff. But
it was,
you know,
totally.
But so that's as much Disney as the panels provided this
actually,
time around.
It did not for me. There was more Disney for me.
Oh, well, I'm sorry that I saw. Excuse me. Yes, I forgot. There's more coming down the pike here. But in the past, they've definitely included a lot. 2 years ago, when the creators of Midsummer Scream were involved with this convention, Scarlet, which they are not anymore, they're not associated with it. But 2 years ago, when they were, the panel they had was, it was, you know, the history of the Hatbox Ghost. It was right after Hatbox Ghost came back to the Disneyland Mansion. And then that panel was led by Tony Baxter and people that worked on building Hatbox Ghost. So, I mean, that one was, whew, that was like Christmas morning going to something like that. Yeah, and that was like, we had just moved to Southern California. And when I say just moved, I mean, we had arrived the night before. We didn't have a place to live. We were staying at Airbnb for a few weeks. And the first thing we did was go to that Scarlet. And that was the first thing. My first full day moving back to Southern California. That was that was why I started off. These guys come with the A-plus material. Also at that Scarlet, they had a panel called, I forget what it was called, but it was Sounds of the Theme Park. Both these panels are on Creepy Kingdom episodes if you dig them up. But Richard Mark Silverman was there, and Corey Burton, who does many voices but does the voice of the ghost host on the Haunted Mansion Holiday, and Peter Renaday, who is the voice of the ghost host on the Haunted Mansion record. So the three of them were just doing a panel, and that was just, again, what's as awesome as Christmas morning? I don't know. Halloween night? I don't know. It was just like, I just ate all that stuff up. Anyways, great stuff. You will hear that entire panel at the end of the show. So if there's no more to discuss on that, I guess we can move on.
Yeah.
So the next thing up was the Knott's Scary Farm panel. They actually had two panels during the weekend. This one was a little bit of an announcement panel, and it was pretty short for a few reasons. One, probably because they had another panel. They closed out the show with a retrospective called 45 Years of Knott's Scary Farm. And that's a long time. And in case you're unaware of Knott's Scary Farm or know what it is, it's not just another theme park haunted attraction. It actually is the creator. They created like the haunted house experience haunts that we all love today. So 45 years ago. So that's pretty nuts. So they had a retrospective, which we'll get to on our next episode, I guess. But also another reason that they didn't give too many announcements is they actually have their own event it's actually happening on August 31st, where they announce everything that's coming to Knott's Scary Farm. So I guess they didn't want to, you know,
give it all away at once.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I think that's really interesting, though, that like I would have never gathered that they were like the originator of the haunted house experience. They don't really like brag about that, I don't feel like.
They don't, yeah. It took me a long time to realize that. I think I just realized that last year, in all honesty.
Which is great. I'm actually kind of glad they don't brag about it, but at the same time, like, that'd be a great advertising tactic.
Right. Well, I would say out of all the panels I went to in this Terrace Theater, which was like, you know, like concerts, like big rock concerts could be in there. This was huge. That was the only one that was like completely filled. Like, and we were in Long Beach. We're, you know, maybe 20 minutes from Knott's. I don't know. Like this was a Knott's town, you know. Like, so right. I don't think they have to let everybody know. I think
they can do whatever they want. Yeah.
I think everybody knows basically.
It was bigger than Universal.
Yeah, I mean, Universal was very packed. That was the second most packed, but Knott's, you would like that. It actually felt like a rock concert, like the vibe in there. Like it was like, it was no joke.
That's great. Good for them.
Yeah, this is a Knott's town over here, and I know like a lot of listeners around the country are, you know, maybe or may not have heard of it, but Knott's Berry Farm as an amusement park has a lot of history. It's been around longer than Disneyland. And has a really interesting history with interacting with Disneyland. It's about 5 miles away from Disneyland, if that, 10, 5 miles, I don't know.
Yeah, it's like a less than 15-minute drive.
Yeah, so it's It's got, if you go there, I know a lot of people that go there now, they're like, oh, this just seems like Six Flags, but they do have their ghost town, which was, they actually says when you go to Knott's Berry Farm, America's first theme park, because that was the first themed area in an amusement park on record, you know, so, and it's still there now. So, ghost town, you know, kind of, you know, a little, you know, kind of like Frontierland a little bit, but probably a lot more detailed and a lot more activity going on inside of all the different shops and windows and
yeah, stuff like that. Much more like Westworld minus the violence.
Right.
Yeah.
And they have a thing right now called Ghost Town Alive where they have all these, you know, it's like you walked back in time. So all these like, I guess, streetmosphere for us Disney folk.
Right.
But so just, you know, just so you're everyone's aware of what Knott's is, if you're not familiar. But anyway, so a lot of what they do, they usually do about 8 or 9 different houses or mazes, whatever they want to call them these days. And some of them come back. They're not all new. Almost all, like, pretty much all of them are original. They very rarely do like IP houses, like Universal pretty much almost exclusively does. So they're all the kind of original concepts that they come up with. And with that, some of them come back and then they, you know, they plus them up a little bit. So they have a house that is coming back maybe for the 3rd or 4th year. I don't remember right now, but it's called Trick or Treat. It's very much based on just, you know, the classic Halloween imagery. And but they've decided to up the ante with it. And they decided to have it where all the lights are turned off inside of this house. And you get flashlights when you go in. So that's what they have announced is coming this year. And the flashlights that they control how bright they are. Sometimes they turn off. You know, sometimes, you know, they get really low. They also will change color to decode messages on walls. So very, very cool. I'm very eager to try this one out as I've been through the Trick or Treat house a few times and I do enjoy it. But I'm glad that they've upped the ante on this one. So get ready for that one. And that was the only house tease they gave. But another staple of Knott's Scary Farm for maybe at least the past 4 years, but before that, many years. I think there's been a total of 10 years out of the 45. Is that you know, the Queen of Halloween, Miss Elvira, has had a stage show there where she'll perform the show 3 or 4 times a night during Knott's Scary Farm, which for a lot of people, I mean, they would just go to see an Elvira stage show during Halloween, like independent of going to a theme park. So a lot of people, that's worth the price of admission right there. So they Elvira did come out on stage, which I guess wasn't too shocking because they did announce that Elvira just on Saturday was going to be appearing and you could meet her and sign autographs. And
yeah,
all that
she
stuff.
She was basically on almost the front door of the convention.
Yeah, and she was not dressed as Elvira also. It was Cassandra Peterson.
Right.
Just so you know. But she did come out and she did state that Elvira is coming back to Knott's Scary Farm this year, but that it would be her very last year doing her show.
No.
Yeah, which a lot, you know, it was an audible bum sound. But it's not too shocking because I kind of feel that Cassandra is not just done doing Knott's Scary Farm. I kind of feel like she's done being Elvira. Like she's been Elvira for so long. You know that.
Right.
I feel like she's tried to retire several times.
She has. She had that show a few years ago where they were trying to make the next Elvira.
Yeah, wow, you remember that, yeah. I thought I was the only one that saw that.
Nope, definitely saw it. And I was really into it. And then, you know, like, I was actually kind of bummed that it never worked out, that somebody else didn't take the reins. Because I think the character's so great. I'd love to see somebody else take the reins and continue doing it. We just live in a different time period, right? Where like movies and stuff aren't watched at 11 p.m. at night on a Saturday night on Channel 4. You know, like that's just not how we watch entertainment anymore. So it's kind of sad to see like the host of a movie go away.
Yeah. The horror movie host is definitely a dying genre if it's not already dead. And we live in a time we can watch whatever we want when we feel like it. But I'm sure that will. I don't know if Elvira as a character will live on, but I know that there's still people trying to keep it going. I mean, they're not on, you know, our local channel, but I mean, or, you know, Channel 4 or whatever, but I think they're trying to come alive. But Elvira as a character could theoretically live forever, which I think they were trying to do that show. That was 10 years ago, that show. I just remembered. It was on in 2007.
It was a long time ago, man.
Yeah. And that was before she came back to Not Scary Farm. So she really, when she didn't retire, she really went kept it going. So, but anyways, it was last year. So, and I said we did a full review of last year's Not Scary Farm, and I know there's a lot of our listeners who have never been to haunts and think that it might be too much for them, or they're interested, they want to dip their toe, but they don't want anything too extreme. I mean, Knott's, I think, is a great place to start. It's definitely a haunt. It's not Mickey's Not So Scary. Like, it's definitely a haunt, but there's so much of the spooky fun, not over the top of the gore imagery you're gonna get at Not Scary Farm, as opposed to other experiences. And come check out Elvira for the last time. That sounds
definitely
really, sounded really morbid. I was like, but it's true, it's the last time. So I might actually, I don't know what I'm doing on actual Halloween, but that might be kind of cool to go to the actual last show on Halloween there. So though, I don't know, I might have to make that happen.
Buy your tickets soon.
Yep. So that'd be cool. But anyways, so that's all Knott's had to give us. A little tease. We'll be reporting more on what's coming in Not Scary Farm after their announcement show on August 31st. All right, so moving on to the next panel. This was you, Josh. You went to the Ben Cooper's costume. So why don't you tell us about that or explain what that was all about?
Yeah, so if you're unfamiliar, Ben Cooper is probably the when you talk about costumes, we're not talking about cosplays. Mm. We're talking about trick-or-treat costuming for kids. And Ben Cooper is probably the most infamous of several different companies and brands. It's ended up gone. It's gone away now. But for a long time, Ben Cooper was at the forefront, mostly because of licensing. And his granddaughter was there and talked a bit about her grandfather and the family business and Halloween. Her not necessarily knowing at a very young age what her family did, but definitely knew that Halloween was a very big deal for them. And her grandfather, Ben Cooper, was such a great businessman, almost like a guy who would not let up. For several years, he would go and get licenses for characters that were well known, like a Mickey Mouse. They showed Mickey Mouse costumes and other Disney character costumes. But he also was licensing characters that weren't even out yet. When Star Wars came out and before the next film, before Empire Strikes Back, they had concept art of Yoda. And he got the license to do Yoda a year or two before the film even came out.
Wow.
The funny part of that is the concept art shows Yoda as like a neon blue. So for the first few years of Yoda costumes, they were all blue. And now those are collectibles. Those costumes that people would buy at the time for $2 or $3 are now going for $12,000.
Holy crap.
They had a Spider-Man as well. The Spider-Man that came out early was yellow, not red. And then Spider-Man came out and they realized, oh no, our costume looks nothing like this. But again, if you can find a yellow Spider-Man costume, more power to you.
Wow. So it's
they also
before you continue, say these costumes. These were the ones. What was the time period? It was so it's 70s. Was their heyday?
You could go back to I think the 60s.
Okay.
Early 60s, and then you know move forward a couple of decades. But I mean, this was something that was just like incredible as far as licensing. One of the first people to ever do licensing in costumes. And it gave them, you know, the benefit of the doubt when you talk about IPs and what people want to experience, especially mm-hmm. now in theme parks and other things. Like, the trend is to do stuff with IPs because people are familiar with it and know it.
Right.
Same with costuming. You know, like, outside of, like, dressing like a clown or something really generic, you could dress like Batman or you could dress like Spider-Man or Mickey Mouse or whomever. And Ben Cooper was one of the only people doing it. Sometimes at a fault, like the Yoda costume. But for the most part, you know, the costumes were unique and interesting and pretty well made for the time period and for the product that it was at that point. He also spent, I think they said, somewhere close to 10 years trying to get the license from Jim Henson for Big Bird.
Wow.
So when I say relentless, I mean relentless. Like, he was gung-ho about making sure that he could get these costumes for some years, for, you know. And then one of the biggest challenges that they had was in the early 1980s and 82 in I believe it was Milwaukee. They had a case a few weeks right before Halloween, a case of a guy who killed seven people because he had poisoned Tylenol pills.
Wow.
And they were so worried about people lacing candy. And that's really where the fear, you know, when everybody says, you know, oh, like, don't take kids trick or treating or like make sure to check all the kids candy before. That's where it came from. That's where it was established. That
never
idea
knew that.
Was established
that's
there.
That's nuts.
And those few years from like 1981 or 1982, like up until 1985 or 86, the Halloween costume trend dwindled, and they almost shut down because of it.
Wow.
But because of licensing and everything, you know, ended up making it out. It really is a fascinating story, something that I think a documentary or a long-form podcast would do really well with, because it's a story that I don't think anyone was interested in knowing about, but once you start hearing about it, then you know. It was actually my favorite panel I went to all weekend. And that's saying something, because it was my least interested panel going into the weekend.
Really?
And now leaving it, I was so ecstatic about children's costuming, you know, it was so crazy, but it was a great story, totally great story. And, look up Ben Cooper costumes and read about it, because it was fascinating.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's funny you say someone should do a documentary about it. I'm like, it's very interesting. And, yeah, maybe I'll do it. Why not? I'm a documentary maker. but I do remember those costumes when I was a kid. I was born in 1976, and I mean, everybody had it. It was basically like it was a mask that was made out of plastic just on the front, rubber band around the back of your head, and then a basically like an apron that you would lay over the top of you. You know, the
costuming is weird, man.
Yeah. But everybody loved one. And interesting, my cousin actually had the Big Bird one year when we went trick-or-treating. I seen the picture, so I didn't know he had such a coveted prize. That
yeah, yeah, really.
That's awesome. I mean, that's, I don't know, I'm jealous that you saw that one.
I'm sorry. I'm sure you saw stuff I really wanted to see. You did get to see Elvira. I didn't even make it to her, you know, signing area, but you know, well, I did have fun while I was there.
I'm glad to hear it. All right. So moving on to our next thing here. There's a panel for Six Flags Fright Fest at Six Flags Magic Mountain, which is here in Valencia, California. So as, you know, pretty much everyone knows around the country, United States, and I don't think they're out of the United States, but all around the United States, there's Six Flags parks, the roller coaster parks, and as far as I know, almost all of them have this event called Fright Fest, but each one is its own thing. You know, they're not all tied together. But since it's a Southern California event, they had a panel at Midsummer Scream, just like they did last year as well. So they, you know, they definitely gave out a lot of announcements and all that stuff. But some of the highlights here, which I thought were very interesting, was that they are offering a VIP experience called Hidden Haunts VIP Tour. It's a backstage tour of Magic Mountain where they actually tell actual ghost stories that have happened over the years that Magic Mountain has been there.
That's great.
So that's kind of a cool thing because I've never done a ghost tour at a theme park before.
No, that's super unique and good on them for doing something like that because they can't compete with Universal or Knott's Berry Farm, I don't think, and even to an extent with Mickey's Halloween Party.
Right.
I don't think they can compete on that level.
No, I mean, they're definitely, I feel like that Magic Mountain in particular, that they're on the come up with that. They know that they have fierce competition in this market, and not even just with the theme parks. There's just, Southern California is a hotbed of haunted attractions and Halloween attractions, probably more concentrated than anywhere else in the country. I mean, Orlando may be second, but there's just so many you know, people working in the entertainment industry that on their, you know, that take on these side ventures, you know, mixed with all the theme park ones.
Right.
It's just, I can't keep track of them, you know, and luckily I don't have to, but I cherry pick the ones to tell you guys about if I think that if they're something you'd be interested in. But anyway, so I think that's a pretty cool idea, and I mean, I've gone on ghost tours in towns, like, you know, like walking around the streets and stuff, and
sure,
and I enjoy those. I'm not like a big like paranormal like ghost hunter kind of guy or whatever, but I like hearing about, I like hearing stories about strange things that happened, like where I am at this moment. You know, like, you know, because the stories are unexplained, right? So they're calling them ghost stories, but they're just unexplained stories, and I find that pretty interesting. I would like a ghost tour of Disneyland. That would,
I mean, seriously, like that would sell. It would at least be a great VIP, you know, tour that would sell out maybe once a day, 20 tickets at the least.
Yeah.
Why not do it? Like, you've got the people working there for tours.
Well, we just gave them a great idea. All right, Disney.
Right.
Let's do it.
Pull it off.
So, but one of the things that they did announce that is returning, that was there last year, something that I loved, you know, it really doesn't have much to do with Halloween or haunts, but they just didn't have another opportunity to do something like this, is that they had a Suicide Squad experience, because Six Flags has all the licensing for the DC characters in their parks, and they have tons of roller coasters named after Superman and Batman and all that stuff. And also, Magic Mountain just opened up a ride that's like Toy Story Midway Mania, but it's I think it's called Battle for Metropolis or something, where you fight the DC villains.
Yep.
Which I've yet to experience. So, but I think that would be kind of a fun addition to the Suicide Squad experience, which what it was last year. Well, I guess they have like a DC area at Magic Mountain, but they kind of took that whole area, did like projection mapping all over all the facades, and there's tons of I don't know the names of the characters, but there was in Suicide Squad, the Enchantress drew up all these like kind of demon monsters.
Okay.
In there, and there were tons of those around, but the real draw was being able to meet and take pictures with the over the top characters of the Suicide Squad, which would be Killer Croc, Katana, and of course Harley Quinn, And I say, of course, because that's who I was most excited to be. The Joker was there, too. He's not part of the Suicide Squad, but, you know.
They always add him into stuff anyway, just because people want to see Joker.
Right. So overall, I thought it was cool. I really enjoyed it. I also really liked the movie. I know that it's kind of not liked universally. But so that's that. But even if you don't like the movie, I mean, come on, how do you not like Harley Quinn? Even if it's the new version, get over it. It's still Harley Quinn.
You know? Right.
It's still awesome. It's not something that I thought was going to happen. I never thought I was going to go to a theme park and meet Harley Quinn. You know, I thought it would, you know, I'm like, oh, I could probably go meet, you know, Mickey Mouse. You know, I'd say that's pretty likely, but I never thought that I could go meet Harley Quinn. So that was a lot of fun. So that's coming back as well. So have you ever been to Magic Mountain?
I have. Yeah. And, I enjoyed my time there. I ended up riding maybe like 5 or 6 roller coasters there. If you've ever not been to Magic Mountain, let me just tell you, it is literally 90% roller coasters. There's not much else there. So if you're not a roller coaster person, I would say stay away. But you said, you know, earlier the Magic Mountain is kind of on the up and up. That's true. There are some people, you know, working on different things like the Battle for Metropolis and other things they're trying to pull off. Maybe this is moving in that direction.
Maybe a little bit. I mean, it definitely is a coaster park. I don't think that's ever going to change. I think I don't know how old Magic Mountain is, but it has been Magic Mountain before it was Six Flags.
Yes, so been there a while.
It's been there for a long time. You know, I definitely went there when I was growing up.
And it's closest in proximity. You know, Universal's its closest theme park. And I'm going to say it's just a hard sell for Halloween at Magic Mountain when Universal's so close.
Well, if you're comparing the two, yeah, but it's definitely a different experience, for sure. And I think if you're really going to compare, though, is that you can go experience their Halloween stuff, but then you also have access to all their coasters. You know, so.
Sure. Versus Universal is much more of a nighttime event. You don't get the day as well.
Right. So, you know, it's a hard comparison. I don't think the price point is the same either. You know, and with Universal, like as far production value wise, I mean, that's top tier. Like, you know what I mean? Like that's the,
right.
You know, you're walking into a movie, you know, with Universal. So there's nothing quite at that level, but, like I said, they're on the come up to compete with all the other, theme parks in the market. And just to be able to have those kind of unique experiences, like, oh, I can meet Suicide Squad. I mean, it's not really Halloween, but, you know, it was fun for me. You know, so yeah. And one of the interesting things was that I guess last year they weren't open on Halloween, which maybe.
Interesting.
Yeah, I guess Halloween was in the middle of the week or something like that. Because I think Fright Fest is usually only on the weekends. And so they stated that they will definitely be open on Halloween because they said they had a whole bunch of people show up.
Yeah, I would have shown up. Like, that seems like the busiest day of the Halloween season if you're going to promote it for Halloween, you know, and having stuff there. I don't know. It seems strange not to be open that day.
Yeah. Well, they learned their lesson.
So totally.
They'll be open. All right, moving on. So you went to something that I'm jealous of as well. After this, you went to the Dark Art of Puppetry panel. So let's talk about this.
Yeah, I think when most people think puppets, they think Muppets like Big Bird or the Muppets or whatever. But Jim Henson in particular also really did originate kind of a dark art, you know, with Labyrinth, and other films. And there were so many great people that were talking there. They showed off some puppets. There's actually a great group there called Rogue Artistry, and they've got, they do live shows. But they're also going to be doing an immersive experience in Los Angeles this year, where you're going to be in like a 6-floor abandoned building.
Interesting. Tell me more.
And basically to take like a freight elevator, to the 6th floor, and between these kind of like creepy puppets and actors and stuff, you'll be like saving this girl and trying to get her out of the building. It seems like the preview they showed, that's not even up on their website yet. I'm sure it will be coming, but it was really interesting to hear their take on how they're using puppetry, not just for a stage show or in television, but trying to add it into an atmospheric, you know, situation like that, like a haunted house. And then they had people from, I forget her name. I wish I would have written down her name as well, but she had worked on Dinosaurs.
Oh, I could tell you her name, Josh, because she is featured in Foolish Mortals. And she she has quite a, she's a former Disney Imagineer. She has quite a history of doing many amazing things. And it's Terry Harden is her name.
Yeah, Terry Harden. And she worked on Dinosaurs. She worked on many other things. They talked about kind of the process of creating puppetry, creating movements and using them in a much darker way than being, you know, Kermit the Frog, how puppets move, how they would, you know, have a situation with a human, ways that they would interact in just a darker, kind of creepier way, and maybe more realistic. It was really interesting. I'll be honest, I had to skip out on the last few minutes of it. I had some other, just like one thing that overlapped here, but it was a really great panel overall that showcased what you might expect when you think about the dark arts of puppetry. They kind of talked about everything you wanted to know, and they had a lot of people like Terry Harden talking about, you know, bigger projects like Dinosaurs and stuff like that, talking about Imagineering. But then you had this smaller group like Rogue, who were just like a playhouse of people, you know, that were just kind of putting on shows. So it was very much a great range of bigger to smaller projects and what they were trying to put together, whether it's film or live shows or now trying to kind of create something more immersive. And the art of puppetry, most people, I think, would say that it's dying out, especially with the Muppets kind of having their show canceled on television. But it seems like people want to keep it alive and people want to try and use it in new and interesting ways. And I, for one, love the Muppets. So I love the use of puppetry in any format that you want to do it in.
That's awesome. So you said you skipped out early. I heard from other people about a little argument that happened on stage between Terry Harden and someone else. Did you witness this?
I did not witness an argument, although I would have loved to have been there for that argument.
The argument was, I don't know who the other person that said it, but they were saying that they would rather work with people than puppets. And then Terry chimed in saying that she would rather work with puppets than people. And apparently it got heated.
Okay, so this is my thoughts on that, and I wish I would have been there for that because I would have like jumped up and punched a guy. The art of puppetry is different, right? It's a format and a medium that you use. It's a tool. It's the same way we use green screens, right? Like, it's the same way that we use so many other things in filmmaking. It's a tool to tell a story, and whether you like it or not doesn't really matter. You know, they could have made Yoda a dude. They could have made him a puppet. They could have made him a special effect. Whatever the case may have been, they chose to do the format they did as a useful tool towards something else. So they were trying to tell a larger story of Star Wars with a tool being used in there. That's not taking away from puppetry at all. It's embracing puppetry. You know, like there's a lot of robotics that you would consider puppetry. You know, like if you love Jurassic Park, it uses a lot of puppetry. In that, that's because they were able to do certain things that CG couldn't, and CG could do certain things that puppetry couldn't. But using those tools that they had together, created, you know, Jurassic Park as a masterpiece. That's what puppetry does, is it's a tool to use. And whether or not you use it as a child's medium, which most people would say it is, or whether you use it in a larger format or a more interesting format, which it can be. And I think the view, same with like animation. Animation is seen as kids' cartoons, but we all now find that The Simpsons recreated the format, and then we got South Park, and we got Family Guy, and all these other things. And we've, you know, so like we just need to like take puppetry as something that's not just kids' format. It's something much larger that you can use in any way that you want to, as long as you're creative with it.
To kind of wrap up the puppetry topic, I'm glad that Midsummer Scream did this. They also last year had a panel from the Henson Company, which was kind of retrospective of a lot of things. They did live puppetry on stage, and that was an incredible panel. I was kind of hoping that they would come back, but I guess they, for whatever reason, they did not. But they provided this instead, which is taking a little bit more grassroots from what you said.
Yeah, it was really great. I think that they embraced not having Jim Henson there. You know, their group, and kind of embracing something smaller and something more unique. It definitely didn't have the maybe amount of people that Jim Henson would have, you know, their company would have had there. Mm-hmm. But it definitely had an interesting story to tell. A lot of people had stories to tell, and it was great. I enjoyed it.
Very cool. So the next panel was you again, and it was Are You Afraid of the Dark? So this is a panel on the 90s Nickelodeon show. So
yes.
What was exactly was this panel? Who was there and what went down? Because I have no idea.
They had the director and executive producer of the show. One's the director, one's the executive producer of the show. And they had a long conversation about how the show got started, how they made the film or the episodes. They showed clips. It's funny, Ryan Gosling got his start there, so everybody gave this huge pop when Ryan Gosling showed up on screen, little 10-year-old Ryan Gosling. But it was an interesting retrospective into children's entertainment. Not just about Are You Afraid of the Dark. They did talk about episodes. They talked about how they made the show. But what I took away from it overall is that Nickelodeon was doing really great things in the 1990s as far as just allowing, kind of like what Netflix does now. They just kind of allow creators to create, and they figure out what rules they're breaking later.
Right.
You know, and kind of adapt as they go and re-edit as they go and whatnot. A show like Are You Afraid of the Dark probably wouldn't fly today. They talked about other shows of the time, like Goosebumps, Eerie PA, and kind of the creepiness of those shows.
Was it Eerie Indiana?
Eerie Indiana.
Right.
And kind of the creepiness of those shows. What was different about Are You Afraid of the Dark? Because Eerie and Goosebumps were on syndicated television, there were a lot more rules.
Mm-hmm.
And their shows tended to be more kind of neat, well-rounded shows. The Are You Afraid of the Dark had a little bit more edge to it, and it also tended to not follow formulaic tropes. It actually took after a lot of Twilight Zone episodes, and they actually, almost every episode is a throw to an old Twilight Zone episode in some way. They use a lot of elements or they'd find props or they'd actually hire actors who were in Twilight Zone. The people making the show were such fans of Twilight Zone and other horror from kind of like the 50s, 60s, like sci-fi horror era, that they really incorporated a lot of those kinds of elements and stories into Are You Afraid of the Dark, versus Goosebumps was much more your cut and dry, here's a werewolf story, or, you know, here's a ghost story. Are You Afraid of the Dark was a little bit more weird than that, and it incorporated those things, which was great. And kids' television and entertainment just isn't allowed that freedom as much anymore. And I think that one of the things I'm actually going to talk about on Modern Mouse Radio, not a cheap plug, but I'm just stating that it's one of the things I am going to talk about, is that the 1980s and 90s really gave a lot of content to darker imagery. Not just, you know, Nickelodeon or Are You Afraid of the Dark, but like Disney did too. You know, you could say that, and for the shows, what I'm saying is there's this entire kind of like gothic subculture that really stemmed from, you know, A Nightmare Before Christmas, The Black Cauldron from Disney, and then stemmed from Are You Afraid of the Dark or Eerie or Goosebumps. And there was just so much more of kind of a embracing of horror as when I was a kid that's not really out there right now. We've kind of made horror be more like Twilight than anything else. Not really scary. And it's just an interesting take. It was an interesting panel and kind of knowing that, and they bring it up, they brought it up several times, and then they went over several episodes and how they made them. This is a panel I was really looking forward to. It wasn't my favorite. Like I said, the Ben Cooper one was, but it was a panel I enjoyed. I would definitely be glad to put down my $30 or whatever, $35 to go to this panel, along with several other stuff throughout my day. So I'm glad I got this panel in.
Wow. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it too. I never really watched the show, as whenever it came out, I was just past the age that it was targeting. So, but I know a lot of our listeners love it. And but overall, what the theme you're talking about, how things used to be for kids, I guess, used to be dark and spooky. I mean, that's kind of what this show's all about. It's about those kids that grew up, you know, and it's that sweet spot between, you know, intense horror and just a little bit of spookiness. You know what I mean? Like, it's
right.
You know, it's not, it doesn't have to be one or the other. There's this little middle ground. And I think another important player in that, which I just bring it up now because I don't know what else I'm going to bring it up. I definitely saw it throughout the weekend represented through cosplay and various other art and stuff, was actually Beetlejuice. I think
huge.
I think Beetlejuice coming out. I mean, I'm sure I'd seen other things before that, but I know that that left a huge impact on me. And for something like that to be a huge mainstream hit movie, you know, I think the impact of Beetlejuice is actually, you know, without Beetlejuice, there isn't A Nightmare Before Christmas, you know?
I think all early Burton stuff, you know, you're talking about Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands, Batman, Nightmare Before Christmas, all that stuff really plays into this kind of like new gothic subculture of people. I'm not categorizing people in anything. Like, I would definitely categorize myself as somebody who's interested in the gothic and kind of the more grotesque in life. But those elements and those stories brought me into that world as kind of a gateway drug. Are You Afraid of the Dark did that too. So,
yeah, well, it sounds like an awesome panel. I mean, you know, it's pretty unexpected. I was surprised when they announced it, you know, but that just shows the range of offerings Midsummer Scream has there. So moving on, the next thing on this list here is you paid a visit to the screening room, which is something that we haven't even discussed yet. But which, again, that could be an event all on its own, completely separate. Throughout the entire weekend, they had series of blocks of shorts, of horror shorts, different themes.
Yeah, Horror Buzz was putting it on, horrorbuzz.com, and they were basically showing stuff from noon, which, like, the convention opened at 11, so starting at noon all the way until 7 p.m. when the convention closed. So you could literally sit in that room all day and not see anything else.
Right. I will say that the running the audio visual in there are friends of mine, Eric and Amantha. So shout out to them for grinding through that 2 days in a row. you saw the block called Folklore Frights. And amongst those films was a film called Slit, which a friend of mine made, Jen Nagel. So did you check out Slit?
I did. I got to see everything in the screening. I think there were five or six in total. Here's the thing about short films, and I've done several short film festivals, and actually specifically horror short film festivals, is what's great about them is that you go in and you spend an hour and a half, 2 hours watching a few shorts. And if you don't like something, something else starts 5 minutes later.
Right.
Which is great. You know, you're always going to find at least two or three that you probably don't care for. And then two or three that you're like blown away by. For me, Slit was the middle ground. That's not bad or good. I don't know what the budget was. I don't know what, you know, went into production. All I know is what I saw. The film kind of falls on Japanese or Asian folklore. That's the name of the whole panel,
right,
or the series was Folklore. And it was really interesting and kind of odd. I enjoyed a lot of elements of this, especially the ending, the creepiness of it. What happens is a girl cheats on her husband or boyfriend, and he basically wishes her bad will and says someone will show up to take her, very ominous. And then, you know, this weird woman that glitches out shows up and walks towards her and basically, like, cuts her face, and then they switch faces. So the effect of switching faces, and the glitching and everything actually was really, really good. I would even say, like, that was one of the better special effects I saw. The story leading up to it was a little, I would say, lackluster. I'm just not, like, into the cheating boyfriend, you know, kind of, it felt like very forced, to get to the point in which it was good, but it was fun. It was a great little short. I'm glad that I'm the one that, you know, gets to review it. I can be maybe honest since I don't know the person making it.
Right.
I would definitely be interested in seeing more, and seeing like what else they had to offer. The shorts in general were really good. In particular, there were a couple of foreign films, and they actually, I think, did the best with the audience, typically because when foreign films screen to an English audience, writers and directors know that language is going to be a problem. And so actors tend to act out more.
Yeah, physically than verbally.
Yeah, more physically than verbally. And because of that, you know, you get some great moments, especially with horror. Right. Because now you're really like emphasizing where the scare is going to come from. And so you're not really like pushing jump scares as much. You're really emphasizing the physical and moving, like the camera becomes a character. All the foreign films were really great because of that. They have to get over that hump to begin with. So the writing has to be very thoughtful in that respect. But a lot of the American films were good. There were some that, again, a couple you just are going to go in and be like, wow, this is not something I enjoyed, but I did enjoy the entire block as a whole. And I wish that in retrospect that this was a whole day in of itself, or that this was something completely separate from Midsummer Screen, because I think a short horror film festival would work out and sell out theaters no problem.
Sure. Well, maybe they are planning something like that.
Yeah.
So very cool. All right. So to round off today, or day one, with Severus Scream, they had the Queen Mary Dark Harbor panel. Now, in the past, we've done some episodes on Queen Mary's Dark Harbor. I don't know how familiar you are or are not with it, Josh. What do you know about it?
I am. So I have not been yet. I'm going to go this year. But I do know what's great about the Queen Mary is that it's already kind of scary. The boat itself has a lot of ghost stories. A lot of people say it's one of the most haunted places in the U.S.
Yep.
Being harbored in Long Beach. So it's right down the road from the convention center. So with already being haunted, you already have this kind of like eerie feeling about the boat, and then you're adding characters and haunt experiences to the boat itself to kind of just create an intensified horror element on top of the ghost stories that exist there throughout the year anyway.
Right, yeah, I mean, it's definitely one of the most unique places to do a haunt. All the haunts and the mazes that they do are based on legends and of the ship, you know. So it's and they do they do a lot, and I mean, the environments are creepy already, but just to they had three, but now they announced they're doing four. Four of them are actually in the bowels of the ship. So just walking around there without any added thematic, you know, elements is already creepy and scary.
Right. And is it for Dark Harbor? It's basically one price, right? So you're getting,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, you're getting an extra haunt this year for the same price.
Right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It's, Queen Mary Dark Harbor, those guys, gals, the team, they're up there with you know, with Knott's and Universal, you know, they're playing on that level of skill and production value, and just overall entertainment, with their environments, with their costuming, their makeup, their performers, the characters that they've created, the people that do them are. Like, they have some ones in the haunt, but they have some that come out and walk around or do stage shows and that are usually dedicated people. And those people are top-notch improv, comedic, ridiculous people. Like, such a high-quality event. I can't speak enough praises about Dark Harbor in case you're unfamiliar. So so this was kind of their big reveal for the year. That's what they used Midsummer Scream for. Did it. And they came out with a bang. They did announce that they're adding a new experience on the ship as well. I said I'm not going to get too into all of those things because that I feel like that could be a whole separate show, to be honest. but of course we'll be covering it. And plus, you should go as well if you live in Southern California or if you plan to visit Southern California during. Halloween time to hit up the big stuff like Disneyland, Mickey's Halloween party, or Universal and have you. I would definitely throw this one on the agenda as well, especially for our, you know, Long Beach isn't in Orange County, but it's on the border of Orange County in LA, so it's only like a half an hour from Disneyland. And also the Queen Mary is a hotel year round. So you could book a room there for the night and continue that really sleep at a really haunted place. but one of the cool things is that they don't necessarily always have new mazes. They kind of have these characters. They have their own maze, and they change and grow and get bigger and better. So every year you're able to just, you know, fall more in love with the characters and get really attached to them. And it's kind of – and it's great because then they're – you know, it's like you're going back to the Queen Mary to have another one of their adventures. Like the storytelling is like super rich here, you know, from year to year. Absolutely love it. One of the things they announced and one thing that's, to point out is that this is the only Halloween event in Southern California that allows alcohol. All the other events do not. at the major theme parks, at least. And I guess that's a big hit with people that go there.
Yeah.
So they've announced that in two of the haunts, they've added secret bars. So you have to figure out where they are by probably information online, they said. I don't think you're going to stumble upon it. And then once you get in there, they have secret bars inside the haunts, which logistically, I don't know how they're going to pull that off, but that sounds pretty incredible.
That does sound cool.
Yeah, so... yeah, and they, like I said, if you wanted to, you could just make yourself have a really great night. They have private cabanas for rent. A few they, on Halloween, they have a costume ball, which went to last year, which was a whole bunch of fun. Like I said, I really can't say enough good stuff about Queen Mary's Dark Harbor. Yeah, and it was a great way to end that day of panels because they had two of their characters on the panels along with the with the head team there, and which was the sea captain, which is just, he looks like just a regular old sea captain like outfit, you know, but his face is green and scaly, and he was drunk, he had a vodka bottle in his hand, like it's just, and then they have the ringmaster, this over the top lady who was just genuinely funny. Like, I think like the ringmaster and the sea captain could do like a stand up comedy show, and I would pay to just go see it right now. They were killing me every step of the way. So, that was it as far as panels go. And we're gonna just to briefly wrap up. I'm not gonna get too into this either. Like, it sucks. I mean, we could probably be sitting here forever talking about all this stuff, but we're just like touching on all this stuff, and we're already over an hour.
Right. So,
is that the Queen Mary's Dark Harbor did host the official Midsummer Scream after party called Sinister Circus, which took place on the roof of the Queen Mary, which, you know, was an after party. That pretty much all the characters were there dancing around, and you know, that DJ and all that stuff. They didn't have any haunt thing for real, you know, but they had a little bit of a haunt area where you walk through like a spinning tunnel, and then after that you walk into this other area, which I thought was really cool. I'd never seen anything quite like this. There was like a green laser light that went across the tent about waist level, and underneath they had fog. So you literally could not see anything underneath that layer. So you walk through the room and it's very weird because most people have never seen anything like that. I haven't. But then as you start walking through, they had scare actors jump up from underneath that area. So because clearly they could see the people's feet underneath the laser beam. And to add on to that, once you walk out of there, you see that there's like a little television screen and with a big red button. And you look on the TV and there's actually – it's a – shot of the camera from inside that tent, and if you hit the button, it makes a loud, you know, ship noise, you know, like a horn ship noise, and then you can see the people jump. So people outside could actually scare people walking through the tent as well. I thought that was pretty neat. So I just wanted to, both those things were cool. You could definitely see a clip of that on our social media, because or not of the scaring horn thing, but of the weird laser beam fog thing.
Right.
So it was very cool. And it was a costume contest as well. There was a few Disney things to be found there. I found some Disney villain trio, Cruella, Ursula, and the Queen of Hearts. And then ran into somebody I knew. Her name is Lindsay, but she was dressed as a Tower of Terror bellhop with a sign over her that said "out of service," which I deemed the best costume of the night. So we all know how bitter Tower of Terror fans are on the West Coast. So I had to give it up for that. I'm not one of the bitter ones, but I feel everyone's pain though. I got you. Got to go to Orlando if you want to go down Tower. But anyway, so that was that. But you got to experience the escape rooms, which throughout the day. So why don't you talk about that as we close up the show?
Yeah, I did 2 major escape rooms. I've done a few around the Los Angeles area. I'm huge on puzzles out here because you can get kind of like this whole entire festival of Halloween. You can get a lot of people who work in Hollywood or work more in the entertainment business to add their 2 cents into things. Mm-hmm. So anywhere else in the country, escape room is very much cut and dry. The puzzles are there. You escape and it's fine. Here in Los Angeles, there's a lot of horror themed escape rooms or more thematic escape rooms, if you will. And I really love them. 60 Out was there. I've done a 60 Out pirate ship escape room before. I recommend 60 and Out to anybody who's not like super into horror or being afraid, but really wants the theme stuff. But then the Cromwell Estate was there and Crossroads was there. Crossroads had a great little 10-minute escape room where it was you were put into a padded cell in a straitjacket.
Oh, wow.
And you were basically told you and one other person could be in the straitjacket, or if you did it by yourself, you could do it one-handed, I believe. But you could go in and figure out where to get certain keys to locks on the straitjacket that you were wearing and be able to unlock yourself. And then you were actually given the key in one of your pockets or your hand or whatever the case may be within the straitjacket. So then to get out of the door, you had to find the key that was basically on you.
Oh, wow.
Which was a great little escape room. They did a great job in the padded room. You know, how themed could a padded room be? Well, they did a great job as far as adding more as if it had been used, a little worn. It was a little like moldy, mildewy, not real mold or mildew, but it looked like that. The outside of it looked like it was like a steel metal tank. They did a really good job at that. And then the Cromwell continued the story from the actual escape rooms. If you've ever done the actual escape room, the Cromwell is the story of a man who owns a house that you've gone into his estate. But he has cut the gas line to your car. And so you're kind of stranded in the middle of nowhere. So you end up in his house and when he's not there. And you kind of get the impression over time, I won't give away anything, but you give the impression over time that he's not a very nice person. Mm-hmm. And he'll probably hold you prisoner if you don't escape. And so the continuation of this is now that you've made your way out of the house, you find yourself in his shed where there's secrets of something that he may also be doing. So you're trying to actually find his secrets. And they used a whole map of Los Angeles within the shed. They used several different like corkboard tricks. It was more than just put the key in the lock kind of puzzles.
Right.
There were a lot of like matching things and whatnot. It was really interesting. I would say Cromwell Estate is one of my favorite escape rooms in all of the Los Angeles area. They were my favorite escape room here. And I would suggest them to anybody. And I think that if you're not into scary haunts, you're not into jump scares, this is a different version of horror that is still horror and very interesting and very fun. I would suggest escape rooms, especially the Cromwell Estate and Crossroads, above anybody else almost.
Awesome. Well, I mean, I am friends with Evan from the Cromwell Estate, so I'm really glad that you gave your unbiased review.
No, he's a cool guy. I love talking to him. But yeah, like even before I knew him, I experienced the Cromwell and I loved it. So I'm glad that he continued the experience and made it a great escape room.
All right. And the last thing I can't forget I want you to talk about is your experience going through the Order of Billeth. So I want you to explain what that was all about.
Yeah, Order of Billeth. So I guess I heard this. Jeff Heimbach is a good friend of both of ours, and he's been kind of in the midst of creating an immersive experience to go along with his audio drama podcast, Return Home. And the Order of Billith is this idea of kind of a religious cult, and so much so that they did such a good job at the convention that I guess people complained to management.
Yeah, that happened on Sunday. Yeah, did you hear the full story on that?
That people were... No, I did not hear the whole story on this.
Well, we're not, we won't tell the whole story on the show, but people complained to the management that someone was trying to recruit them into a real cult. So that's how we're going to
job great. That's, that's what they wanted. And I actually asked Jeff later, you know, I said, like, are you afraid that this is going to turn into some kind of Scientology situation? You know, where like you really have now created some strange religion. But the whole idea of this kind of scavenger hunt going around the entire convention that he and a team of people created to figure out how to kill this disciple that was attached to Billith, who's this goddess or not goddess, we're still unsure. And it was so interesting to hear all these actors kind of play out roles and, what they had to say. There was a lot of improvisation that was going into, you know, everything. Obviously, if I asked questions, they had to answer me. There wasn't a script to it. So everyone did a really good job with this. I would say, talk of the town with my group, the Order of Billith, was their favorite thing. They're continuing to do events and continuing this story of a strange cult that is either summoning a goddess or a demon or something. It's weird and it's so strange that I don't think, like in this case, horror fans didn't even get it. It was so not on the surface. It's very Twin Peaks, very Twilight Zone. It's so different and weird. Right now, I don't think there's much like it, but they were definitely like out there trying to recruit members for their cult, their weird fake cult, for this immersive experience. And people were buying into it and loving it. And like people were coming up to me, even at the convention, they gave you like a marking on your forehead as you were going around for the scavenger hunt. And people would come up to us and ask, you know, where we were in the scavenger hunt. It was a great way to kind of get people mingling and interacting.
Wow.
I don't even know if that was their intention, you know, but it got people mingling, and it was really cool to see that, not in a cult type of way, but definitely got people talking about the experience. And I hope to see them succeed more with it. It was great.
Awesome. Well, that's a pretty good review. Not quite the, I'm going to complain to management review, but very cool. All right. Well, is there anything that we didn't bring up that you wanted to say to conclude your day?
You know, there's a lot of things that I probably want to talk about, but not enough time, like you said.
Right.
I think I gave a great general feeling. If anybody's interested in knowing more from us, I'm sure James will have a lot to talk about in future episodes, or you can email him or go check out Midsummer Scream next year to get the feel. It was a great feel, a great vibe, great convention overall.
Yeah. If you've gone to a lot of Comic Cons or horror conventions, and say this feels different than all of those things. It's such a warm and awesome feel there. There's a real excitement in the air that's just not, I don't know. I've been to a lot of conventions in my life, and this one just feels different. I know a lot of conventions feel like they're trying to rip you off every step of the way, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Especially for, and like, I love the D23 Expo, but really the D23 Expo is a larger advertisement for a brand that we already buy into. This was much more grassroots, but grassroots not in the way of like a kitschy, you know, thrift store kind of looking.
Right.
I don't know. Yeah, it was much more like, you know, you're not buying mom and pop wares. You're buying into an entertainment industry that just so happens to be a fan of itself.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And I'll just say that at most cons of any type, when there's celebrities there, you know, they charge for signed pictures or to get photos. And as far as I know, I don't know if this is wrong, but as far as I know, whatever celebrities have appearances there at Midsummer, they are not allowed to charge. So yeah. I don't know if you saw that being challenged anywhere, because I mean, Elvira was there, and I don't know whether that was the case with her or not. Sid Haig was there, more famously Captain Spaulding from The Devil's Rejects.
Yeah, I didn't approach them, but it did seem like there was a line of people around them, but they seemed like in really good spirits and they were having a fun time. You know, it didn't seem like a job for them.
Yeah, not at all. Yeah.
So
that's just a little hint of how this is a different type of thing. And I think next year is going to be bigger and better. Stick with us. You'll know all about it for sure. if you weren't able to go, if you did go, we'd love to hear what your thoughts are on some of the things, or you know, whether you agreed with us on some of the experiences and all that stuff as well, which could be reached at creepykingdom@gmail.com. Well, Josh, before we go and let this Tower of Terror panel be presented to all the listeners, why don't you tell everyone where they can catch up with you and what's coming up next on your podcast, The World That Never Was.
Yeah. World That Never Was is wrapping up season 2. You can listen to the whole thing. There's 6 episodes in all in season 2, 6 episodes from season 1. They're each like 30 minutes, so they're easy to blast through. But it's a great show. I totally recommend it.
Do you?
Very. What?
I said, do you?
I do recommend it. And you know what? Not very often can I be a fan of my own work, but I am a fan of The World That Never Was. Because I serendipitously kind of make it, and it's really interesting that way.
It's interview based too, so you're the conversations you have are, you know, you didn't know what you're gonna get before you had them, so it's a journey for you as well. So
correct, and it is definitely a journey for me, and I love, you know, creating that journey. But network1901.com, you can find Modern Mouse Radio, which is my weekly show that I do every Wednesday. The World That Never Was is just wrapping up. I'm going to be starting a new show on Fridays, starting very soon. And so maybe out by the time that this airs, called Animated Devils, kind of a psychological look at villains in Disney films. And we'll be looking at just all kinds of crazy, interesting history and backstory stuff with that show as well. And we've got tons of stuff going on our YouTube channel. In fact, we're going to have a video from Midsummer Scream up at youtube.com/network1901.
All right. Oh, I just realized we didn't really say what The World That Never Was about. We just keep saying it's coming.
I guess so, yeah. World That Never Was, great show. Just go check it out. No, World That Never Was is the easiest way for me to say it is it's about some of the ideas that Disney had for its theme parks, but never built, and why, and strongly emphasis on the why. So we go and explore a lot of political or social issues that were plaguing the Disney company for a period of time, and that's why something never got built. And so I get to interview people who aren't necessarily just into Disney, but are also a part of other things in the world. I got to talk to a lot of great people over the past 2 years for the show. I recommend it just for the stories from these people alone, not for my narration, but but the stories are so interesting and unique, and it's people's take that are in and outside of the Disney community. So, you know, it's an interesting show, and I think it's unique.
For sure. And the last episode you have coming up is probably released the same day as this one, but so it should be out by now, is Beastly Kingdom, the land that was supposed to be built in Animal Kingdom. You may have noticed in Animal Kingdom logo, or I don't know if they changed it or not, but they have a bunch of silhouettes of animals. One of them was a dragon. And you may say to yourself, I don't see any dragons in here. Well, it's supposed to be a land of mythological creatures which I guess now is Pandora, but so that replaced that. Not, I don't know if you discussed that point or not, but either way, as I was telling Josh Ford recorded, I don't know the full story why Disney never built this. So I'm pretty excited to listen to that episode, and I'm sure all the Creepy Kingdom listeners are too. So it's network1901.com. That's where you can find it.
Yep, you can find it there. Easy, clickable to get to it, so it'll be up there.
Awesome. Well, Josh, I want to thank you for helping me cover the event and sharing your stories with all the listeners. I'm sure they all appreciate it because you told some great stories of panels that I didn't get to experience, and so you helped me be able to get the word out.
Yeah, I'm sorry you didn't get to experience it, man.
Well, what can you do? But, I think I'll be bringing Josh along on some future Halloween adventures as the Halloween season is just beginning. And for new listeners of the show, I cover Halloween events on bonus episodes called Creepy Days. So I'm sure you'll be back on for one of those events.
Yeah, and they'll be coming up soon, man. It's all coming all at once real fast.
Yep. So hold on to your hats. This is the best time of year for all of us, so get ready. So, all right, enough rambling. Without any further ado, presented in its entirety, the Tower of Terror retrospective from Midsummer Scream.
That door is open once again, but this time it's open for you. Long Beach, 2017. Amid the hustle and bustle of the Southern California seaboard, Midsummer Scream is a star in its own right, a gathering place for the Halloween event. Now, something is about to happen that will change all that. Today's presentation is something that calls for a different kind of production. This is being recognized as the Terrace Theater, still in operation. We invite you to dare sit back, take a deep breath, into this territory that you live fast. And this theater tries to run into you. The Twilight Zone.
Fabric and environment, which is the MGM studio. So that toxic forever.
Now, tower is a big attraction. Takes up a big footprint. Was it always designed to be the weenie at the end of Sunset, or how did that evolve?
Well, I think in the beginning it was going to be much closer to the hub area of the center of the park, and we realized how tall it needed to be for the experience we wanted to have. We did say for spectators to push back. So that was really a challenge for the team to convince management to spend the money to build Sunset Boulevard to go up to where the tower was today. But I think after it was done, everybody agreed it was the right decision. Much more spectacular to see it at the end of that street and creates an entirely new kind of life for the show.
And this was fairly new after Team Disney kind of hit their stride bringing in a lot of expansion in the company.
Right.
What were Michael and Michael Eisner and Frank Wells, were they strong proponents of this?
Michael Eisner for sure was. He loved it from the beginning and really wanted to do it. So yeah, it didn't take a lot of convincing to do the tower territory, more convincing, as I said, to do the land leading up to it and get that extra infrastructure approved.
Sure, sure. And so when you decide that you're going to do the tower territory, at what point then is the show writer brought onto this?
Well, I think the writer is part of the team from the beginning. We were a big group, as many people as fit in a room. And the writer is just the guy who wrote it down. But it's really a team effort to come up with the concept. And once we decided it was going to be built, we had a whole bunch of thoughts. Is it an insane movie director? That was one idea. Is it Stephen King? And Mel Brooks?
You hear that come up a lot now in the day of podcasts and that type of thing. You hear people say that, and I had never heard that before. So there was something to that.
It doesn't get very far. I mean, it's cards on the wall, but when we decided about Twilight, that's just seemed like a natural property. Michael Eisner was not convinced. Apparently, he didn't watch as much TV. But we convinced him.
That's great. And so how was it a challenge back then to bring Twilight Zone on as an IP, get it over the family, or how did that process kind of work?
That was kind of by the studio, the lawyers and attorneys, so we weren't really part of that process, but it took some negotiations, of course. It wasn't impossible, obviously.
Sure.
Michael, do you remember how long into the project it was before you landed on it's going to be Halloween, it's going to be the setting and the time period and all that?
I think it's about an hour and a half. No, I have no idea when that happened. But it sort of built up. We picked 1939 specifically because this is a movie park, and 1939 was a great year for movies. I think it was Wizard of Oz, Out of the Wind. A whole bunch. So that was that's a good time. And it's golden age Halloween. And it just sort of went on from there. And then Halloween seems like a pretty natural time to do it.
I think we're okay with Halloween being the focal point. So then also as it progresses, you get a lot of art going on with them. And then Corey, you're brought on, right, as art direction for this?
Yeah, it's actually the second production designer, art director, I think it was David Jones, David Carter.
Yes.
And I don't know why he left, because it was such a great attraction, but when I came on, the project was just about to go into production, and we also were behind in coming up with what the fifth dimension should be. And I remember there was an outside special effects company that had tried to do a heavy fog kind of mock-up, so I was gifted with a shoebox full of knee fog nozzles and no-nos, and we had total panic to get the fifth dimension done. So we brought in Gerard Howland, who was the opera artistic director in San Francisco, and we were going into production and designing the fifth dimension all at the same time as a lot of
fun. That's really, really cool. And so I'm a show writer. By day, I'm a show writer. So I far along are you in the process as far as artwork and then figuring out who's going to do it? We're going to get to you, Mark. I know they want to hear from you. We're going to find out about how the voice came about. But how far along are you in your final script before everything starts really going?
The final script happens after they track the vocals. That's a joke, right? Final script, we put it on the script, but it never moved. It changes. In fact, once we record it, even after we record it tomorrow, we have to ride it and make sure it fits, because there's ride timing that we have to live with. For instance, the video you see in the library, it had to be 88 seconds long, and no more or less. So our director, Joe Dante, he thought he was going to make a movie. And we had to say, no, it's an 88-second movie. That was tough for him. He says, no, it's going to be great. I love it. It doesn't matter what they love. It's going to be 88 seconds. And
amazing. So the story is set. Everything, all the wheels are turning. Everything's set in motion. At what point does Mark Silverman get the call that they're looking for people to do Rod Serling voices?
Oh, me?
Well, why not you? I think you were there.
Okay. Well, I have only been a voice for a while. I was working at K-Rock Radio doing weird prank phone calls to celebrities. And I started getting a lot of jobs revoicing celebrities. And I was doing a few things here and there. And then I got a phone call from a friend of mine, another voice actor. And he said, his agent said they were looking for a Rod Serling voice for a Disney World ride. And I remember thinking, how do you connect Rod Serling to Disney World? It was crazy, you know. So I ran down to this audition, and I read it to some, it was some agent's first day on the job, and I read it into some tape recorders, like a big ghetto blaster from Radio Shack. And, you know, I read the thing, and I didn't really think much of it, because there's so many people involved. And then 2 weeks later, she called me, the same as agent woman, and said, hi, Mark, I want you down at Disney Imagineering for the Rod Serling thing again. I said, wow, really? And I was such a Disney nut back then that just getting into Imagineering and walking around was the most exciting thing. Because I wasn't even thinking about getting a job. So after a few more auditions, they kept telling me that I was right at the top of the list. And then there was one final audition at Imagineering, me and some other guy. And I went into some big sound stage and read it for Joe Dante and a few of his assistants. And they came out and told me I got it. And that was that.
I'm thinking at this point you guys kind of want to hear what he read. Take a drink and then unleash the beast. We want to hear this.
All right. What was it again, you want to
Twilight Zone.
Hong Kong, 1939. Amid the glitz and glitter of a bustling young movie town at the height of its golden age, the Hollywood Terminal Hotel was a star in its own right, a beacon for the show business elite. Now, something is about to happen that will change all that. The time is now. Well, what's the next one? The time is now. I'm leaving very much like the one you just witnessed. Tonight's story in the Twilight Zone is somewhat unique and calls for a different kind of induction. This, as you may recognize, is a maintenance service elevator still in operation waiting for you. We invite you, if you dare, to step aboard because in tonight's episode, you are the star. And this elevator travels directly to the Twilight Zone.
Necessarily came to the opening of the ride, and I just, you know, whatever, as
And I said, do you want to go on the ride? She goes, sure. And then a couple other people said, oh, I'm not going to do that. That sounds too scary. She goes, oh, come on. Don't be chicken. Let's go. So great support. She loved it.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, let's talk about how you can do the recording and everything you set in motion. Let's talk about the construction of Tower. And were there any challenges along the way of getting this thing in, or anything that was unexpected that you guys ran into, or was it fairly smooth?
Well, I can start off by saying, I think one of the things I've failed with this before is one of the challenges we have with this ride system wanting to be and how big the building would be, with the story of that building would be. As we looked around Hollywood and thought, what is a really tall structure that would fit in the time period? And we looked at the shaft of Mark and some other mission in Riverside, and we looked at that period and said, you know, a hotel makes the most sense for a building of that size. That's really how that sort of came before deciding what the actual story inside it was. So, you know, because you can see from these pictures you have that it's a massive structure. There's a lot to go in and just to accommodate the systems that present the show and then take care of the ride. So from there, it was a challenge on how to fit the skin and keep it thematically beautiful and storytelling. Maybe you
could
talk a little bit more about that.
This is definitely one of the... I've worked on a lot of projects. I've probably worked 30 years until a few years ago. And this is the hardest attraction to build, absolutely. In every possible way you can imagine. And the construction of it just... It's just under 200 feet tall. It's really 1 foot taller than it is. It would have a light on it. So keeping within those kinds of things, parameters. The physical construction of just having to climb up, we call it the Stairmaster, because we had to climb up and down all day so many times. Everything was a challenge. The outside is so thematically intense with the traits that have to come together to create the really authentic decaying plaster and those sorts of tricks, and the amount of surface to cover. I think the paint we had to drive down to Kissimmee, which is, 20 miles away, and use binoculars to take the whole thing in and give radio instructions to the painters. I mean, everything was just way harder than anything else I've ever worked on. And that made it a lot of fun. And the ride system, too, was probably the bigger challenge. It was the biggest elevator Zotus has ever made, powerless thing. And someone didn't quite understand the ride control demands, how much it had to be digitally accurate in every stop. We literally, the power panels in the engine control room, the elevator control room, blew off the wall, and I think we were almost 6 months away. It was barely finished. So everything was really difficult. And of course, we all beat that up, so it made it more fun.
What was really interesting about this is it was built in an era that it's kind of hard to imagine now, but it was built in an era where there wasn't really any social media. There weren't Disney World fans taking pictures and tweeting, the construction and all that. And so I know, just hearing through the pipeline back in the day, that there were tourists arriving at Walt Disney World and driving around trying to figure out where they could check into this hotel. That was a thing back then.
Which was awesome, because at one point there was even an idea to see if there could be a real hotel and a thrill ride in one building, which couldn't imagine how that would work.
I remember there was a drawing of the elevator used to fall through the bar. There was dozens and dozens of story about that.
That's interesting. Corey, did you work on those storyboards that, at that point?
Well, we had David Durand, and I think he had literally a 5 foot or taller pile of storyboards at the end of the project, because every time there was a slight change or suggestion, he did it in the panel for it. I've never seen anybody draw like that. He's unbelievably great artist.
I found something in the building in the script when Michael Lasser, you know, he was imagining the building and he had the ride, and he said, well, I want to see the people falling into the elevator. So, okay, we have to put a hole in the building. You know, why is there a hole in the building? And that is actually the story. We had to respond to that. Okay, so it's lightning and all that stuff that dissolved away. So it was an afterthought, you know. It was an adjustment to the building itself.
Sure. Started as a walk-through attraction. I think that arguably some of the best attractions in the world, Haunted Mansion, Pirates of the Caribbean, Tower of Terror, all started as a walk-through attraction. Right? It's hard to imagine that way now.
Yeah, I want to mention something else about the photography. I think of the challenge of the building, you know, the just the rises of the double top drop and the fifth dimension all concept made it really, really massively wide. And we looked at the model, we said it just looks too big, you know, it's too existing. So we turn the whole thing, as you can see in these pictures, to like three-quarters of a three-quarter view, sort of like a Super Bowl tournament, you know, the best model. So it's
well, it is super sexy. It's
yeah, it really is great. You know, we're talking about this project moving forward in the construction phase, and everything's getting pretty far along at this point. I would be remiss not to bring up the fact that we lost Marty Sklar. So, does anybody have, do you have any direct dealings with or any funny stories or anything about Marty coming to visit the tower that you guys were working on? I heard he didn't like the drop, was it?
Well, the other thing I remember right now is our show producer, Lane Ikeon.
Yeah.
She didn't like the one on the ride, and opening day, Marty grabbed her and pulled her into the, he says, if I'm going, you're going. So they both broke.
There you go.
I think that's the only time she ever
broke. Marty was a great champion for everything that we're doing. I worked with him for almost probably 35 years. So, and he loved engineering, and loved his mentees, as we, I guess we could call them. So he was very enthusiastic about this. Really wanted to happen, so, but I don't have any funny stories.
Yeah. That's okay. I have something funny. I want Corey to explain what the hell that is.
That's Corey on the left.
Yeah, I have the smaller of the shoes in them. I thought I'd throw that in because actually the backstory of choosing this was towers, unlike almost every other attraction, again, seemed to bring out a growing list of the team's fears, personal fears, right? So the obvious, you know, fear of the dark, fear of heights, fear of elevators, fear of the show producers, fear of ride, you know, so we just became more and more aware of everyone's, you know, personal list of what they're terrified. So often, you know, we did these interviews, you know, in this case it was Bozo visiting Walt Disney World, and they let him, you know, talk to us, and he wanted, you know, someone to explain the ride, but it's not there, but actually go on, it was rather difficult. But, so anyway, so this project manager, I usually did them with these interviews on camera, so no big deal, and she was always fine with it, and for some reason she just was not able to go out there with him, and it turned out she had a fear of clowns. So I'm not mentioning names because I sympathize with any of that as being real. So it was just odd. It was the weirdest thing.
That is weird. Yeah, that is really weird. So it opens in Florida, and it's an amazing, amazing opening. And I remember the first time I actually went to Walt Disney World. The tower was fairly new. And again, there was no social media, so we were kind of knew what it was about, but we didn't. There were no spoilers to be seen online or anything like that. There wasn't even on the internet, and it was infinite back then, right? So I remember going on the first time and just going through the gardens. I mean, the queue areas, going through the gardens, and the cracked fountain, the broken fountain, the hardware is still in it, and then you make that turn into the grand lobby, and it's just staggering. It really is. It's so beautiful. You guys did such a beautiful job, you know, designing that aspect of it. And then getting on the ride itself, and you know that it's a drop ride, and you can see people and hear the screen. And I'm telling you, you're in there white knuckled because the lights go out and Mark's spooky ass always comes on. And you're just waiting for it, you're sucking up back of the seat, and you're waiting, and then it moves out into the fifth dimension, which was mind blowing. I mean, now, right, you know, trackless ride systems are fairly common, but back then, that was mind melting at that point. And you forgot for a few seconds that you're moving through the fifth dimension. Oh shit, there's a drop coming up at the end, you know. And it was really beautiful the way that was. Were there specific challenges getting that elevator, that ride vehicle from the first shaft to the drop tower through the fifth dimension?
Yeah, the attraction is three drive systems. There's a simple elevator system that takes you up, which we call the lift side, and then the drop elevator, the big driving elevators that make you go really fast. And then connecting them is this AGV, automated guided vehicle, whatever it stands for. And that was a new technology, and it had its difficulties, you know, getting it fine-tuned. I mean, that was my most terrifying ride. It was the first time we broke from the lift side to the drop side. And I was in there with all the ride team, and they were arguing about whether we'd done that check to make sure the elevator cab on the big drop was actually guaranteed to be there. So when the doors opened and it's in the dark, everybody had their flashlights out. Like, I was really there.
That first drop was a doozy, right?
I have to say, every time I went on the ride, I've done it hundreds of times, I am worried about that. About it was, you know, Disney is not going to let something like that happen, so it was a baseless fear. But you still, of course, what if that platform was there to catch you and you just went down?
The attraction is kind of, if you think about the sequence, especially the one in Florida, it is all about doors. So we wanted to, every time you were up against some pair of doors, you wouldn't know what the room would be. So it starts in the lobby going into the library with the automatic doors opening out, and then the surprise of the sliding secret panel, and then the more expected elevator doors, and then when you go to the fifth dimension, you're likely not expecting that the whole vehicle is moving out through the door. So yeah, we're trying to build up suspense and surprise the way the attraction is choreographed.
And Mark, when they're describing this attraction to you, I mean, you got to, when you're in a sound booth and you're making this recording, you got to be wondering, what the hell is this, what's going on with the record? Did they explain it to you? And how was that when the first time you wrote it, actually hearing that experience involved once?
Well, they did explain it to me, but I never got the scope, the magnitude of it, you know. It wasn't until Regis went up on the Walt Disney World Christmas parade. There was some kind of little bit with Regis on it. And when I looked at that, wow, this thing is huge, you know. So when they sent me out there for the grand opening, it still was beyond my wildest imagination. I had no idea this thing was going to be that massive, you know. And finally, to get to hear my own voice on this Disney attraction was so oddly satisfying and peculiar. Because I was so obsessed with Disneyland as a kid, I would go in with my tape recorder, and my pockets were stuffed with blank cassettes, and I would record every room, every sound, and I had them all in boxes, all these cassettes. And there I was, opening night, with that same tape recorder, and recording my own voice, so it was really crazy. But the ride, it was better than I even could possibly imagine. And I think I went on about five times that night. And I wanted to come on with Carol Serling, but she just got out right when I went on. But it was such an event. And they gave us free Cobb salad that night from the restaurant at
Disney's here in Cleveland.
But yeah, that was good. It was terrific. And then I went back to the All-Star Sports that night and slept very well.
Well, I think that anybody who's been on the Florida Virgin knows, I mean, when you move to the fifth dimension, when that celestial door just appears and opens in darkness. It doesn't matter if you've been on, you know, 100 times or it's your first time. Your heart kind of does a little dance in your chest.
I can recreate that. You are about to discover what lies beyond the fifth dimension, beyond the deepest, darkest corner of the imagination, in the Tower of Terror.
So Tower is a hit in Orlando, and so there's the team, there's the construction team there. You guys must have felt like proud papas when it opened. Yeah. What were your feelings? What were your feelings on an opening night or day or whatever? You had a big moment.
Well, I'll just say overall, I think it was one of the, if not the one of the biggest highlights of my career, because we had a great team. It was something completely. Not the Twilight Zone part, but the attraction was something completely unique. It wasn't a variation of another, you know, omnibus ride or different theming of something that was brand new. And again, the team was spectacular. So instead, we knew we created something that was to be memorable and would live on and on and on. So it was a great experience.
I felt the same way. I mean, imagine at some point, not just in a room typing on a computer. Couple of years, but it takes many years later, there's this actual building, and like Mark, I had no idea what it was going to look like, and how big it was going to be, and how complicated it was. So it was real, amazing.
And it's kind of amazing for you, because as a show writer, you go into this profession knowing that like 98% of the stuff that you write never will see the light of day. So when something does pop, and it's this, it doesn't get better than that.
So, opening day, they bring in a lot of press, radio and television, and the writer is even asked to talk on some of these things. So I'm talking to this radio guy. I don't know where he was from. And he'd been talking to Corey and Eric, you know, important people. And then he said, "What do you do on the attraction?" I said, "Well, I was a writer." He just said, "Well, that's a ride. You look at the ride." So I wrote the name on the building.
It is pretty amazing, but you guys, we are so lucky because there was a blank piece of paper, and then there was one stormy night long ago, and the show right here with us. That's so cool, and I love that. I'm as a writer, man, I hear
us. I just like to say that at one point we had two writers, and we wore that one out. And Kevin Rafferty was still at Magic. In the early days when we were brainstorming, Kevin was on the team, and he left to do something. I stayed there the rest of the time.
Corey, how about you at opening?
Well, at the end of any, when you've completed an attraction and it works and the expectations are exceeded, and yeah, you get this incredible sense of pride. And when the team gets along so well, and you just like everyone on this project was able to, you know, everything came together in terms of, you know, there was enough money to do all the details right, and everyone was really proud of the work and how they were able to get so much into it. I mean, that, yeah, it's just it's way beyond even the usual pride you feel at the completion of the project.
So that is the legacy on the East Coast. And then about 10 years later, its sister attraction opened just up the road here in Anaheim. And let's talk a little bit about what it took to bring Tower to California Adventure.
Yeah, I was the producer this time and creative director. And the mission was, no pun intended, the mission was to recreate Exactus in Florida. But there was some magic percentage of the budget available and some other requirements. The height was an issue too. The footprint had to be smaller. There was a lot of difficulties in translating an exact lift when you can't really do exact lift. So the other thing that got identified in Florida was that HED, that horizontal transfer system, was the cause of most of the downtime in the attraction. So there was a lot of pressure to just let's not do that. And because of the smaller footprint and everything, so that's why it became smaller good fortune moment was the architects, John Elson, who did all the finishes. They figured out a very clever way to recreate a high level of detail, but save a lot of money. So since we have a fixed budget, we were able to put all that money that we saved on the building into the show, so we could recreate the level of detail in the show, which seemed more important than not compromising that experience. So everything, you know, comes down to then how do you play out all of those moves and make it still the same show, but you don't have, you know, three rides since you only have one. So we worked out some system where there's two vehicles in an elevator shaft, and so one's riding, the other's loading, unloading. So it's a tight timing puzzle, but everything is shown that's in one side of the attraction in Florida, that all shown in the same elevator shaft. So we came up with a new scene to replace the fifth dimension, so we wanted the same, you know, show effect impact for that. And that's really about moving through a very disorienting space, but there's also an element in that people have ridden Florida. But there was a moment where we actually take your specific photo and it shows up in the Twilight Zone icon eyeball that's part of that show. So we wanted to do something as a replacement that put you specifically as a guest into the show, and that's why the door's open and there's a big mirror, and we do this special effect as if you, the guest, now are being transformed into a ghost. So you saw the ghosts in the pre-show, you see them now as you're part of the story that we're telling in the Twilight Zone ride, and goes on from there to be fairly familiar.
So we have this thermal image of the guests, and we realize they're not going to know who they are. They're not going to recognize themselves. So that changed the script. So we have the wave. We tell them to wave their hands. And now they can see that, oh, that's me. So that's the reason we asked them to do that.
Go ahead, Mark. What does it say at that point?
Wave goodbye to the real world. For you have just entered the Twilight Zone.
So you do get called back, and they say, we're going to do this thing in California. It's different. It's got different scenes. We need you to come back and record. I'm sure that they really had to twist their arm for that, right?
Yeah, I went in, but you know, the pre-show was the same. But all the other stuff was all new.
And you were in Florida. You were the Florida executive. Right?
Sorry, excuse me. I went to the original director.
Okay. So now we're starting to draw. Then it's Michael doing his little adjustments. Corey's moving up and moving on in those positions. Mark's getting callbacks to record things. And then it goes international. And we have the tower opens in Paris as well as Tokyo DisneySea. And Corey, you were on for Paris, right? And were you on for Tokyo? So no, it ends there. So let's talk about bringing it over to Paris.
Again, the idea was to recreate this time in California. The French folks have familiarity with the Twilight Zone. I think it aired like only half the number of episodes that we got here. So they were familiar with Rod Sterling, the sense of supernatural that is the whole crux of the attraction, and seemed to make sense of the way we were telling the story. They were familiar with it. I'm not the expert to explain Japan, but I'm familiar enough to know they didn't respond to
it. They didn't. They had been shown there once, but they didn't remember.
Yes. That's fundamentally why it changed.
And they respond differently to ghosts and spirits there too, right? It's a different type of...
I don't think that was part of it, but there are different ghosts in Japan. But it was basically, they don't have a big feeling about Rod Sterling and the Twilight Zone and that music. The music, you know, was a real key to other places.
Yeah, absolutely. It's part of our Thanksgiving here in America, right? But the tower is beautiful, you know, all over the world. And Tokyo is obviously very different than any of the other versions. I've never been on it. Have you guys been on the Tokyo version?
Yes, I have. It's really great. It's a great experience. It's a safe and visual experience, but story-wise, it's completely different. It also takes place in the American waterfront land area, and that has nothing in common. So it really felt like that. I think even if the Twilight Zone was popular, it probably would have been a harder fit to put it where it was going with Tara. So
yeah, I was the writer on that as well. So we as Eric said, we had to fit into 1901, the American waterfront. So this lavish hotel got a lot more eccentric and lavish, as you can see. And we invented this guy, Harrison Hightower, the Hightower Hotel. And he's this kind of wacky guy who collects things. And he's a little bit on the underhanded side of things. So he runs afoul of this sort of voodoo fetish doll. Causes. Now we have a reason for the attraction, a real instigator for what's going on, rather than just something mysterious. There's an actual villain in this little nasty little dog.
And it's great. I mean, now that we do have social media and the internet, all that, I mean, I've seen it, and it's a great, what you can see. It's a great attraction.
I was disappointed because I was spending so much time with my tape recorder practicing Rod Serling in Japanese. And then I was disappointed.
Excuse you, it's improved to the worst still. We're going to understand this.
That's really interesting. So, you, Mark, you do this at the drop of a dime. And I know the Disney parks, some people have heard you in other places than the Disney parks.
Do you know what's weird? It's impossible for me not to ride any elevator and not get into it. And the best one was, I was at Target for the other elevator, and I get in, all these women in these strollers, and I said, oh, just do it. And the elevator door's closed. And I went, you were the passengers on the bus. And some people looked at me like I was nuts. But then some people wouldn't even look, But it's difficult for me to get into an elevator now.
And as we head into the moment right here, looking back at the legacy of power, it's such a stunning accomplishment, really. I mean, I think it's a cornerstone of the Disney parks. When you reflect on things, when you go to when you go to Florida and see it, in a way, it's a lifetime ago, but it's also got to be, oh man, I remember that. And you kind of reflect this on how you feel when you see the tower.
Well, if I could speak to Florida, I mean, I've been on some of the other ones too, but I think, and this is true of a lot of attractions, and it's kind of something that, I don't know if we inherited from Walt or just from Walt doing, but is waiting at the exit of the attraction and seeing people coming out giggling and screaming and, let's do it again, and all that kind of stuff. That was worth every ounce of sweat and pain and sleepless nights to get done, because everybody is so excited when they get on that attraction. That means you design the winner, and you might not get
it. I don't think we need to talk about it. Just real quick, how long? But from green light to open day for Florida, what timeline are we talking about on Tower?
Well, I don't know. I mean, before green light, there was a lot of time, too. There was a lot of concept work.
Before it opened in 1989, and it was a big hit already, but there was enough to do. So it was probably, we probably worked on it for a year in design, and then 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I think I'll at least 3 years.
It opened in 1994, so 4 or 5 years after the park, opened. So it was somewhere in the 5 year zone, something like that. Tower was part of there was like a horror neighborhood for studio at one time, obviously.
I think that was later.
Was that later?
Yeah.
Well, there's another pile of discarded ideas that was equally tall.
We want to hear a little bit about a horror neighborhood, don't we?
I was going to say, when you work on something for 3 years, after a while you figure it's not going to go. Because you work on a lot of things you don't. And that was what this was. I wrote a show called The Mystery Writer Theater that uses the technology of the Pepper's Ghost effect with a writer and his characters appearing around him. And we totally scripted it and designed that whole show. We worked on that for 2 or 3 years and it just went away. But there was also the Creature's Choice Award show. Can you talk about that?
Jesus or a modern character as part of that. It was great fun.
Yeah, I think that's what he's talking about, the Tower of Terror. The Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
The Twilight Zone really is about supernatural, not haunted things. And it felt like the neighborhood started falling apart. It was really like focus on celebrating the brand of the Twilight Zone and make that, just as strong as possible. So, and if everyone maybe rather than have three okay things, make one awesome, amazing thing. And that's what we set out to do.
I think they accomplished that. What do you guys think? I did want to do one thing. Can I have the house lights up just a little bit?
Oh, there's people here.
There are people here. There are a lot of people here. Not everybody. I wanted to do this when we talk about the experiences you have as a team bringing this together and the experience of waiting at the exit, hearing people come out and laughing and talking about it. Right? If you have been on Tower of Terror in Tokyo, can you stand up? If you have been on Tower of Terror in Paris, can you stand up? If you have been on Tower of Terror in Orlando, can you stand up? And if you have been on Tower of Terror in California, can you stand up? Look at all the people that you guys affected and touched. This is your audience here. Where have you been? They've been in the line without a backpack. There's no way to get on it. I want to thank you guys so much for being here today to kick off Midsummer Scream. We have a history of starting our shows, our conventions, with spooky-ish attractions. And, for years, we beat the Haunted Mansion to death. And in a lot of ways, Tower, I think, is on a parallel trajectory of this Haunted Mansion. It really is paranormal, it's spooky. The detailing is second to none on the attraction. And it really has a legacy that lasts generation after generation. And it's been made around the world in different iterations, maybe. And maybe here in Anaheim in a different iteration. But the idea is there, and to create something that is just so endearing and has forever become part of our cultural DNA, especially as theme park fans and haunt fans and horror fans or whatever, thank you. Thank you so much. I can say that Mr. Mark Silverman, being the shy guy he is going to be more than happy to meet any of you guys out in the lobby if you want to take pictures and talk to him and all that. I'm sure that disappoints you guys, right? So after the show, we'll have Mark out in the lobby to say hi to you guys. Anybody have any closing thoughts before we wrap this chapter up?
Well, welcome back to those of you who are in a friendly room. Something you won't find in any guidebook. The next time you check into a deserted hotel on the dark side of Hollywood, make sure you know just what kind of vacancy you're filling, or you may find yourself a permanent resident of the Twilight Zone.
Thanks again to Josh Taylor from Network 1901 for helping me cover all the awesomeness from day one of Midsummer Scream. On our next episode, that's right, we will have day two. Little Nikki who some of you might know as the person who runs the Foolish Mortals social media account. She's going to be on the show to help me run down the entire day two of activities. You're not going to want to miss that. And that show will include the entire panel from the Halloween Horror Nights Hollywood panel. Great stuff ahead. But before we get to that, if you want to contact us here on the show, send me an email, creepykingdom@gmail.com. And if you went to Midsummer Scream and want to share your thoughts, please write in. We would love to read some of those back next episode or on a future episode. I have a feeling the next one is just going to be just as long, so I'm going to have time for feedback on that one. But anyways, if you don't want to miss anything that we put out, whether it be the podcast episodes, blog posts, videos, whatever it may be, the easiest way to do it is to sign up for our mailing list. And you could do that by going to creepykingdom.com. Guys, we have a lot of exciting things in the works here that just almost ready to announce. So excited. Lots of fun Creepy Kingdom activities and events and things. So just a little tease for that. Hopefully we'll be able to announce that stuff soon. But this is the best time for Creepy Kingdom yet. So I'm really excited about it. And I'm excited to share all the stuff we've been working on with you. So get ready for that. But until next time,
keep it creepy.
I have to go now. It is midnight. Pleasant dreams.